This episode of Solving JFK is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. This episode is brought to you by Infinite Epigenetics, a first-of-its-kind health test that was developed in partnership with researchers at Harvard, Duke, and Yale. This test is unlike anything I've ever seen. It shows you your risk for the top five chronic diseases, things like diabetes and heart disease, and it gives you a personalized plan to help prevent them based on your own DNA. It kind of sounds like something out of sci-fi, but this is real and it's groundbreaking. Infinite Epigenetics is the only test of its kind that looks at your epigenetics. Here's what that means. It's not just looking at your DNA, it looks at how your genes change based on your daily habits. The test measures 105 health markers, things like vitamins, cholesterol, metabolism, and general immune system health. That's far more comprehensive than any single doctor's visit. And the best part, you don't need to go to a lab or give dozens of vials of blood. You just take the test from the comfort of your home. Go to infiniteepigenetics.com/JFK and use code JFK to save $150 per test for your entire first year. That's infiniteepigenetics.com/JFK, code JFK. Live infinitely with Infinite Epigenetics.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
So far, in our expedition to uncover the truth about who killed President Kennedy, we've looked at the Secret Service, finding that there were numerous instances of security stripping and anomalies in Dallas, many of which were tied back to a single agent, Winston Lawson. But there was no clear explanation for why Agent Lawson took the actions that he did. We also analyzed the role of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, finding that while Hoover failed to relay a couple of mafia threats to the Secret Service, it wasn't likely that he had foreknowledge of the assassination. However, Hoover was likely involved in a cover-up after the fact with Lyndon Johnson, based on the transcript of the November 23, 1963 conversation between the two men. In that recorded phone call, which was mysteriously erased, we only have the transcript from part of the call, Hoover told Johnson that there was an Oswald imposter at the Soviet embassy in Mexico City. Johnson then used that supposed meeting to link Oswald to the Soviets and to apply pressure to Earl Warren and Richard Russell to join his presidential commission, with the express goal of stopping conversations about a Soviet conspiracy in order to save millions of American lives. In other words, Johnson lied about Oswald going to the Soviet embassy in Mexico City, and he knew that he was lying. After Hoover and the FBI, we then put the microscope on Lyndon Johnson. While my finding on Lyndon Johnson is somewhat disputed by a minority of the JFK assassination research community, I found the story of Mack Wallace as the planner of the JFK assassination, the one told by Billy Sol Estes, to be unpersuasive. However, the deep dive on LBJ revealed that he did have motive, means, and opportunity. It's just that there's no hard evidence to show that Johnson was involved in any planning or that he had foreknowledge. But when it comes to the assassination cover-up, the Johnson-Hoover November 23rd phone call makes it clear that Johnson was involved in that part of the crime. We now turn our attention to the fourth potential culprit in the Kennedy assassination, the Mafia. Over the next few episodes, we're going to zoom in on La Cosa Nostra in search of clues that could potentially link the mob to the assassination. In this episode, we cover a brief history of the Mafia in the United States leading up to 1960, including whether the Chicago mob played a part in the Kennedy-Johnson ticket winning the election in 1960.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. Beginning in the late 1800s, organized criminals began immigrating to the United States from Italy. The groups had originated as secret criminal societies hundreds of years earlier in southern Italy, specifically Sicily, Calabria, and Naples. Between 1880 and 1920, there were 5.3 million Italian immigrants who came to the United States. In Italy, the groups had various names, but in the United States, they were known as the Mafia, the Mob, the Black Hand, the Organization, the Syndicate, and La Cosa Nostra. Typical mafia crimes included extortion, bootlegging, gambling, prostitution, narcotics, loan sharking, and racketeering. That word racketeering will come up a lot during this series on the mob. Racketeering is defined as the perpetrators setting up fraudulent, coercive, or extortionary schemes to repeatedly collect a profit. The most common example of this was a protection racket, where the mob would tell a local business that they were protecting it from some threat that wasn't real in exchange for money. Another hallmark of the mob was their willingness to use violence. The mafia used violence to maintain internal discipline and loyalty, to limit law enforcement investigations by witness intimidation, and to influence court outcomes by intimidating the prosecutors and jurors as well. La Cosa Nostra was sophisticated enough to always have legitimate legal businesses as a front. That way they could always carry on their illegal activities behind the scenes. From 1920 until 1933, the United States made alcohol illegal with the addition of the 18th Amendment to the Constitution. Of course, making booze illegal did little to decrease the demand of grown adults to consume a beverage that they had previously been able to have their entire lives. It was during Prohibition that the Mafia came into the spotlight, mostly due to its bootlegging and illegal alcohol manufacturing in defiance of the 18th Amendment. Prohibition also caused the mafia to expand their network beyond just Italians. The mob began to work with Jewish and Irish gangsters as well. In New York, Meyer Lansky, Lucky Luciano, and J. Edgar Hoover's friend Frank Costello all teamed up. The Italians, however, did most of the bootlegging. On the other hand, many mafia-related groups did not work together, which led to violence anytime some other bootlegger infringed on another group's territory. Al Capone was one of the most violent characters who came to prominence during Prohibition. In January of 1925, at just 26 years old, Capone became the boss of the Chicago outfit when Johnny Torrio, who had been the boss, was gunned down. On February 14, 1929, four mobsters who worked for Al Capone went to visit the rival gang, the Northsiders. Two of the men were disguised as police officers and initiated a fake police raid at the trucking warehouse, which was the headquarters for the Northsiders. The two fake cops affiliated with Capone then had the men line up along a wall, at which point the other two men gunned them all down. In total, seven people were killed in the incident, which came to be known as the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. The unwanted attention that was generated from this slaughter led Italian mobsters to begin to coordinate their efforts so that they could avoid bloody conflicts in the future. By 1950, the mafia was a big enough problem that Senator Estes Kefauver held hearings on the Senate Select Committee to investigate organized crime. From these hearings, the committee established that, quote, "There was a national and highly successful syndicate known as the Mafia, involved in a wide range of criminal activities throughout the United States and abroad." The Kefauver Committee led to some anti-gambling legislation and the creation of a new organized crime and racketeering department within the Department of Justice, which got little support from other agencies. Although the Kefauver Committee created some tools for the federal government to go after organized crime, the mafia was still not a top priority of law enforcement. The extent of the La Cosa Nostra enterprise was unknown. That's largely because the mafia leaders were skilled at putting layers between themselves and the low-level thugs who actually committed the crimes. But the chance discovery of a meeting of mafia bosses in Appalachian, New York, changed the calculations of the federal government about how seriously they should take the mafia. On November 14th, 1957, Sergeant Edgar Crosswell of the New York State Police noticed that a large number of people were converging on the estate of Joseph Barbara Sr., many of whom had license plates from far away. Sergeant Crosswell was suspicious of Barbara because he was linked to, but not convicted of, two homicides in northern Pennsylvania. Along with a few other officers, he detained and identified 63 people, all of whom were of Italian heritage, who had been visiting the Barbara estate. This meeting of mob bosses from 10 different states, which, by the way, included Santos Traficante and Sam Giancana, became known as Appalachian. This Appalachian meeting is such a big deal that it's even mentioned by Ray Liotta in the movie Goodfellas. It turns out that this meeting in rural southeast New York was a national gathering of La Cosa Nostra. Because many of the mob representatives who went to Appalachian were involved in union affairs, Some of them were called before the Senate Select Committee on Improper Activities in the Labor or Management Fields, also known as the McClellan Committee, for the name of its chairman, Senator John McClellan. There were two brothers who worked together on the McClellan Committee from the time it began in 1957. John Kennedy, who served on the committee as a senator, and Robert Kennedy, who was the chief minority counsel to the Committee on Government Operations. After the Democrats won the 1954 midterm elections, Robert Kennedy became the chief counsel of the committee. Many of the hearings for the McClellan Committee were televised at a time when the popularity of TV was exploding and there were not that many channels from which to choose. John Kennedy came across as fair and intelligent on television, which bolstered his national profile. Senator McClellan gave the reins of the committee to Bobby Kennedy. At just 31 years old, he led a new committee on union intimidation of organized labor, which served 8,000 witness subpoenas and had 253 active investigations. After the committee wrapped up in 1960, Robert Kennedy wrote a book about unions and organized crime called The Enemy Within. Many of the same mobsters Kennedy pursued on the McClellan Committee, like Jimmy Hoffa, who Robert Kennedy once got into a shouting match with during a hearing, would become targets of RFK when he ascended to the role of Attorney General. As a result of more attention on the mafia from the McClellan hearings and the intelligence gathered from the Appalachian New York meeting, the FBI began to dedicate personnel in some cities to obtaining intelligence on the mafia, specifically on people who attended the Appalachian meeting. In 1959, the FBI began to use an intelligence gathering tool against La Cosa Nostra that was encouraged by Director Hoover, electronic surveillance. If you listen to Solving JFK a lot, you know that I like to keep the vibes up. And that's why I'm a fan of federally legal cannabis from Mood.com. It's a brand that uses small organic farms to source its pesticide-free legal weed. You can get 20% off of your first order at Mood.com by using code JFK. My favorite product of theirs is the functional THC gummies. Usually I go with Epic Euphoria, but I also like Magic Mind and the Pure Relief CBD gummies. These legal weed gummies take about 20 minutes to kick in, and you can control the dosage yourself. Unlike the federal government, Mood.com has never sold drugs to fund illegal wars or clandestine missions. Thanks, Mood.com. So try out some of the excellent legal cannabis products from Mood.com and get a 20% discount off of your first order using code JFK. I don't know about you, but when I need to get into that Curtis LeMay, sitting there watching the autopsy vibe, I look for a cigar that I can rely on. And that's why I love Thompson Cigar. They've been around since 1915, so they know a thing or two about cigars. Whether it's a quick five-pack for the weekend or joining one of their value clubs, Thompson makes it easy to save while enjoying top-notch cigars. It's like having your own personal humidor with deals that you can't pass up. Visit www.thompsoncigar.com/JFK or use code JFK at checkout for 20% off of your order of $75 or more. Discover why Thompson has been America's humidor since 1915 and join the thousands of satisfied customers who trust Thompson for quality, value, and exceptional service. When the smoke cleared and the results were tallied for the 1960 presidential election, Democrat John F. Kennedy had 303 electoral votes and Republican Richard Nixon had 219. The national popular vote was much closer, with JFK beating out Nixon 49.72% to 49.55%. It's been argued by some historians that the 1960 election in Illinois was handed to Kennedy by organized crime. Illinois was one of the last states to report its results, a 9,000 vote victory by Kennedy. But Kennedy already had 34 more Electoral College votes than he needed, which means that he still would have won without the 27 votes from Illinois. However, that analysis misses the dynamic of the unpledged Democratic Party delegates from Mississippi, Georgia, and Alabama, who were all threatening to withhold their vote for Kennedy unless he made concessions on civil rights. There were 26 of these unpledged delegates. In total, 14 of them ended up voting for the segregationist Senator Harry Byrd. So, if Kennedy had not picked up the electoral votes from Illinois, it would have only taken 7 of the other 12 unpledged delegates to flip the election to Richard Nixon. Now, there were investigations into the allegations of illegal votes in Chicago. Two grand juries indicted 5 lower-level Democratic Party officials for vote buying and vote fraud. There were also 677 contempt charges, which alleged that Democratic precinct officials intentionally made mistakes in tallying votes, but those charges were thrown out for insufficient evidence. In 2006, researcher John Binder looked into the voting records in Chicago in an attempt to answer this question, and he found that if there was any voter fraud, it did not impact the election, except for arguably in one of the 8 districts that he reviewed. Richard Nixon also suspected voter fraud in Illinois, but he didn't contest it because he was worried that a challenge may backfire. Nixon said in his memoir, quote, "And what if I demanded a recount and it turned out that despite the vote fraud, Kennedy had still won? Charges of sore loser would follow me through history and remove any possibility of a further political career." So there is evidence of voter fraud, most notably in the form of the grand jury that brought 677 contempt charges, which were later dropped. However, as noted by John Binder's research, the statistical evidence is not an absolute slam dunk to prove fraud. By the late 1940s, the Chicago outfit controlled over 100 unions. At the height of Al Capone's empire, a man named Murray the Camel Humphreys oversaw 61 of them. His wife Jean told author Seymour Hersh that her husband was against supporting President Kennedy because he had worked with Joseph Kennedy Sr. during Prohibition as a bootlegger and did not trust him. As a quick aside, the issue of whether Joseph Kennedy Sr., the father of John and Robert, was a bootlegger who sold illegal alcohol during Prohibition is disputed. As we just heard, Gene Humphreys said that was the case. And apparently Al Capone's piano tuner also overheard Kennedy Sr. meeting with Capone. On the other hand, Professor David Nassau, who wrote a book on Kennedy Sr., says that stories about Joseph Kennedy's bootlegging were, quote, just farcical. According to Nassau, his certainty that Kennedy Sr. was not a bootlegger is based on Richard Nixon's opposition researchers failing to bring this claim up during the 1960 election. We know for sure that Kennedy Sr. had many other ways of making money. He was a bank president. He owned a Hollywood movie studio in the 1920s, and he made a lot of money shorting stocks right before the 1929 stock market crash. Still, even Professor Nassau says that rumors of Kennedy Sr. working with the mafia on issues related to alcohol may be true. He just makes the distinction that Kennedy Sr. never did any actual bootlegging during Prohibition. If Joe Kennedy Sr. did get the mafia to help with extra votes in Chicago, the big question is, why would organized crime be willing to help John F. Kennedy of all people? Remember, John Kennedy was a senator on the McClellan Committee that investigated the mafia's takeover of unions, where he presented himself as being against organized crime. And Robert Kennedy, who was the chief counsel and the leader of the committee, was extremely rude during the hearings to Sam Giancana, the head of the Chicago Mafia since 1957. When Giancana smiled and took the Fifth Amendment in response to one of RFK's questions, RFK said to Giancana, quote, "I thought only little girls giggled, Mr. Giancana." So Joe Kennedy Sr. had a lot of convincing to do if he was going to get Sam Giancana's help. According to Robert McDonnell, an attorney for the Chicago Mafia, Joe Kennedy Sr. contacted his old friend, William Toohey, who was the chief judge of Cook County, Illinois. Kennedy asked Judge Toohey to set up a secret meeting with Sam Giancana. While Judge Toohey did not know Giancana, he reached out to Robert McDonnell, who did know Giancana and who Toohey used to work with in the state attorney's office. McDonnell told Seymour Hersh that sometime in the winter of 1959 or 1960, Judge Toohey asked him to set up a meeting with Giancana, at which point McDonnell gave Toohey the name of a local mob-affiliated politician to contact. A few days later, McDonnell was summoned to meet with Giancana at the Armory Lounge in Forest Park, where it was agreed that Giancana and Kennedy Sr. would meet privately in Judge Toohey's chambers. McDonnell says that sometime after 5 p.m., he entered Judge Toohey's chambers, where he was introduced to Joe Kennedy Sr. About 20 minutes later, Sam Giancana and an associate walked into the judge's chambers through the courtroom entrance. At that point, Judge Toohey and McDonnell left Kennedy Sr. and the two Chicago outfit representatives alone to do their business. Judge Toohey's sons, Patrick and John, told Hersh that they remembered Joe Kennedy Sr. coming to dinners at their home, and they recalled their dad going with Kennedy Sr. to a Chicago Bears game in 1947. Similarly, according to Thomas King, Kennedy Sr.'s general manager at Merchandise Mart, Judge Toohey was very close with Joe Kennedy Sr. The Merchandise Mart was a Chicago department store owned by Kennedy Sr. Thomas King told Hersh that he witnessed multiple meetings between Toohey and Kennedy Sr., but didn't hear the conversations. Given the statements from McDonnell, Toohey's sons, and King, it does appear that there was a clandestine meeting and some sort of arrangement between Giancana and Kennedy Sr. In addition to Judge Toohey helping connect him with the mob, Joe Kennedy may have had support from legendary singer Frank Sinatra. According to Sinatra's daughter, Tina, a meeting was called by Joe Kennedy Sr. in late 1959 at the Kennedy compound in Hyannisport. At this meeting, Joe told Sinatra, quote, "I think you can help me in West Virginia and in Illinois with our friends. You understand, Frank, I can't go. They're my friends too, but I can't approach them. But you can." Tina Sinatra says that her dad then met with Giancana on a golf course where he told him, quote, "I believe in this man, and I think he's going to make us a good president. With your help, I think we can work this out." Despite this statement to Sinatra, as we just discussed, Joe Kennedy Sr. did go and meet with Giancana in person. But what do we know about whether a deal was actually struck? Former FBI Special Agent William Romer Jr. said in his memoir that he overheard Sam Giancana discussing mob support in the election in return for a commitment from the Kennedy administration, quote, to back off from the FBI investigation of Giancana. Likewise, Judith Campbell, who was linked to John F. Kennedy first, but went on to be romantic partners with Sam Giancana while she was still seeing JFK, says that Giancana told her after the 1960 election, quote, "Listen, honey, if it wasn't for me, your boyfriend wouldn't even be in the White House." According to Robert Blakey, the chief counsel of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, the FBI wiretaps that he reviewed during the HSCA demonstrated, quote, "beyond doubt, in my judgment, that enough votes were stolen in Chicago to give Kennedy a sufficient margin that he carried the state of Illinois." Blakey added that the mafia provided money to the Kennedy campaign, which was delivered from Giancana to Kennedy by a special courier, Frank Sinatra. McDonnell, the lawyer friend of Judge Toohey's who set up the Giancana Kennedy Sr. meeting, told Seymour Hersh, quote, "I don't know what deals were cut, I don't know what promises were made, but I can tell you, Giancana had so many assets in place, they were capable of putting drivers in every precinct to help out the precinct captains to get the voters out. And they had the unions absolutely going for Kennedy. I realize today the unions don't vote as they're told to vote, but in the days of 1960, they did. There was no ballot stuffing. I'm not suggesting that. They just worked, totally went all out. Kennedy won it squarely, but he got the vote because of what Giancana had done. I'm convinced in my heart of hearts that Giancana carried the day for John F. Kennedy." While it's not clear whether Sam Giancana helped Kennedy win Illinois by fraud or by good old-fashioned voter turnout, or perhaps a combination of both, it is well established that Giancana and Kennedy Sr. had a deal. Sam Giancana kept his end of the deal, as we've seen with Bobby Kennedy's rise to Attorney General and his aggressive pursuit of La Cosa Nostra, Joe Kennedy Sr. did not. Next time on Solving JFK, we look at what the Church Committee and the HSCA had to say about the Mafia and President Kennedy, and then focus on Robert Mayhew, the liaison between the Mafia and the CIA. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.